Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Medication Madness, and now Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, it's the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour with guests unafraid to speak the truth about psychiatry and psychology and about how you can make the most of your own life.
And this is Dr. Peter Bregan. My guest today is going to really bring a ray of shining light. But before getting to her, I want to talk a little bit about, yes, last week's show and about the upcoming conference. Last week's show was one of the more moving that I've ever been involved in, and I know it's touched a great many people. It was about Tony Orban, a fine American soldier who became a fine and distinguished police officer who went out of his mind literally on Zoloft, the NID present, also known as sertraline, and ended up committing a terrible assault. And eventually, in his own shame and humiliation and remorse, he killed himself. And we had on the air his mother, Margaret, and his wife, Tracy, both of whom stood by him to the end through his many, many months in jail and through the course of his trial, in which I was a medical expert, and which did not end up successfully, in part because juries simply are not forgiving, understandably, of terrible crimes against women, even if there may be a connection to a psychiatric drug. Well, that was the first time that the Orbans, Margaret, mom, and Tracy, the wife, had spoken in public. And since then, they have agreed to come to our conference. And so, in our upcoming conference, April 26th, 27th, and 28th, on the 28th, on Sunday morning, we're going to have a panel. It'll be the first time that the Orban speak in public about these issues since the radio show. And we're going to add to that panel some other folks who have been through drug tragedies and who have gone on to become real reformers, real loving, outreaching, caring reformers in the field. So it's going to be an interesting Sunday. The conference is really developing into something quite marvelous. It's going to have such a range. It's going to start out with positive themes from me. We're going to feature the nurtured heart approach to raising children with Howie Glasser. He's going to have a whole evening to himself on Saturday night. Friday night, by the way, we'll have our famous chocolate fountain where we all get to sit around and talk and visit and indulge chocolate, and you can meet the authors at the chocolate fountain. I'm going to do a long workshop, in-depth about the best in human relationship and in therapy with Bert Caron, one of the most distinguished, if not the most distinguished, psychotherapist and psychologist in the country. We're going to have a judge from Florida come up and talk about how she has a new approach to helping folks by rehabilitating and by not pushing them into psychiatric drugs, and about her feelings about getting kids off psychiatric drugs. We're going to have just a lot of very positive stuff, and then also the full measure of criticism of the psychiatric approach versus what we in general call empathic therapies. And certainly my guest today, whom I wish I'd known before we planned our conference, but we'll just see what we can do in the future, is Aletha Salter. Aletha, and her last name is spelled S-O-L-T-E-R. She's written the book Attachment Play, How to Solve Children's Behavior Problems with Play, Laughter, and Connection. I love the book. How often have you heard me say that on the air? I often love my guests, but I don't always love their books. I really like this book. It reinforces for me so much that I believe in, and I think it will for all parents. And it's not just about parenting. It's also about therapy, and it's also just about relationship and the importance of play. You know, we have a new little dog in the house. He's a little miniature Sheltie. Shelties are miniature to start with. They look like miniature collies. And this one's a miniature of a Sheltie, just a happenstance. There is no official miniature. And this little dog is teaching us all to play, whether we want to or not. She's teaching the older Sheltie to play. She's teaching me and my wife to play. And she's really this little girl. She's really this little four-legged girl. It's really changed a lot of our experiences in the evenings at home because she makes sure we play. And if the older Sheltie doesn't want to play, she'll go as far as to climb up on her back and grab her collar and pull her collar and even pull her to the ground to get her to play. And after a little snarling and grumpiness, they play. So this is really very, very important in our lives. Now, Aletha Salter, and she can correct me if I'm not quite getting her last name right in the way I'm pronouncing it, she's also created the Aware Parenting Institute, which is around the world. I want to hear more about that, too. So, Aletha, are you there?
I'm here.
I'm really glad to have you on the show. I really like your book. I like your ideas. I think it's an important aspect of all of our relationships, and including parenting. So here's the microphone.
Okay. Well, yeah. Well, thank you so much for your kind words about my work. I'd like to start by appreciating your work, which has greatly inspired me. It's really given me the courage to speak, you know, to support parents in not starting their children on psychiatric medication, and also to support them, and if they want to stop these, you know, the whole route of going to get a diagnosis and treatment. So I felt very supported by your books.
You know, that means so much to me. And as people who listen to the show know, I invite people onto the show like you without having any idea whether you have any idea who I am. And Ginger does the inviting usually, my wife Ginger. Mm-hmm. And 9 out of 10 times I've played some role in encouragement and direction. And it's been a surprise to me, honestly, and it's just a really lovely thing. Well, I think your work is really important. How about telling us a little bit about this worldwide, the Aware Parenting Institute, how people can get in touch with you and the Institute, and then the whole subject of attachment play, I think, is wonderful.
Yeah.
So
well,
what about your
book? My Institute is it's an international organization. I'm in Southern California. But what I have is a certification program for people who want to teach this approach. So we do have almost 70 instructors in 17 countries now. So my books, I've actually written 5 books. This one that, this newest one, Attachment Play, is actually my 5th book. But my other books have been translated into several languages, and so they've gotten into these other countries. So I've gotten known that way. So, and I travel around. I do workshops around the world, and I also do consultations with parents. So it's just been growing gradually over the years. When I wrote my first book, The Aware Baby, that actually came out. First edition came out in 1984. I had no idea if anyone would even read it, you know. So I've been pleasantly surprised. So that's what I do. I'd love to tell a little bit about myself and my background, if that's okay.
Sure.
Yeah, I'm actually half Swiss. I'm a Swiss citizen and a U.S. citizen. And I lived in Switzerland during my high school and college years in Geneva, Switzerland. And
Is your first language Swiss?
No,
or
actually,
German?
My first language is English because I lived in the U.S. until the age of 12, and
okay.
Then I went to Switzerland. I started learning the other languages at the age of 12. So I really had the very good fortune to study at the University of Geneva with Jean Piaget, the famous developmental psychologist. And that was part of my required course for my master's degree in human biology. And so that really got me interested in child development. And then I came to the U.S. and I attended the University of California at Santa Barbara, where I earned my PhD in psychology. And that's and then the turning point for me was getting married and deciding to have a baby. I'm somewhat embarrassed to admit that before my first child was born, that was 36 years ago. He's 36 years old now. Before he was born, I thought I was an expert on child development. I thought I knew just about everything there was to know, but, and it wasn't after he was born. It was just such a humbling experience. I realized how little I actually knew, especially about emotions. I hadn't learned much about emotions, even though I had a degree in psychology. Piaget didn't talk a whole lot about emotions, and it was surprising, the intensity of an infant's emotions. So my baby cried a lot, and I came to realize later, I understood that a lot of that crying may have been because he had a very difficult birth experience. It was a very, very long labor. He was stuck for a long time. So I realized later, I read research on this, that birth trauma can cause babies to cry more than others, and also prenatal stress. So I came to really recognize the importance of stress and trauma on children. And that's one big emphasis of my work. And I found that after, you know, sometimes he's crying, I would hold him. I would just hold him and say, it's okay, you know, you can cry. I knew he wasn't hungry. I'd met all his needs. And sometimes he just needed to cry, and he felt so much better afterwards, and he was so much more relaxed, and he slept so much better, and we just felt so connected after these crying sessions. I came to realize that crying really can be a natural healing mechanism. And so that's a big, important part of my work.
Or crying and holding.
Crying and holding, absolutely. Yes, thank you for making that clear, because it gets so misunderstood. This is not,
I know that's
you know,
what you believe.
I call it the crying in arms approach.
Yes.
As opposed to the cry it out approach, or the sleep training approach, which I do not recommend. Mm-hmm. I really feel that babies and children and adults, and people of any age, we actually need and benefit from someone with us when we're upset. We need that connection. We need that relationship. We need to express these emotions in the context of a relationship. So I have emphasized the importance of crying, and one of my books is called Tears and Tantrums. But my book, Attachment Play, emphasizes play and laughter. So there's really lots of different aspects to what I do. One reason that I started off emphasizing crying is that a lot of people don't realize this, but 80% of parents who abuse their children, and I'm not talking about sexual abuse, I'm talking about physical abuse, who abuse their young children, actually 80% in a survey admitted that their anger was triggered by their child's crying.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
So I think it's very, very important to teach parents that crying does not mean the parents have done something wrong. I mean, a crying infant, even with the best of parents, babies do cry.
And it's an opportunity to do something good. I think it's
exactly.
Crying is an invitation for closeness. How about that?
I like that. I like that. Absolutely. Yeah. So that's one reason I have, you know, gone around the world doing Tears and Tantrums workshops, emphasizing this aspect of it, because that is, I think, the most one of the most misunderstood behaviors of children. And now I was appalled When I learned recently, I don't know if this is really going to happen or not, but there's going to be a new diagnosis called disruptive mood dysregulation disorder. Is that correct?
They got so much flack for doing bipolar disorder in children that they're going to substitute it with this awful new diagnosis. Another reason to drug kids.
Yeah.
I'm sure the drug companies will be making applications to the FDA to cure it.
This is shocking to me because the kids are going to be getting drugged for crying and for having temper tantrums. A child who has a tantrum has an overload of stress. I mean, that tantrum is probably a healthy outlet. You know, it's not. I don't think of tantrums as manipulative devices or misbehavior or anything.
It's all cries for parental intervention.
What was that?
So it's all a cry for us as parents to move on in.
Yeah, to move on in, give attention, find out what's wrong, and if the child just needs to cry, support that. If they need something else, support that. It doesn't mean there's something wrong with the child, and I'm worried that kids are going to start. I mean, they're already are getting drugged for crying and those kinds of behaviors,
right.
and it's really sad because that's. I see that as part of the healing process.
Yeah.
You know,
I'd like to jump right into talking about the this whole idea of play.
Yeah.
How did you get to play as being so significant? Attachment, we all kind of know if we know anything at all. We kind of know about some of the things you and I are talking about right now. What I really loved, not that those things ever don't bear repeating. What I love about your book is the various ways in which you help parents play with their kids to solve issues and conflicts.
Right.
How'd you get to that? And can you give some examples about that?
Yeah. Well, that's all part of this, my whole approach, part of the aware parenting approach is helping children heal from stress and trauma. Part of it is really nurturing the parent-child connection. So play and laughter can accomplish both of those. And the third aspect of aware parenting is non-punitive discipline, and play comes in with there too. So it's really a very important part of this. I do consultations with parents, and so many families are really so caught up in being serious, being too serious. You know, the kid maybe had a problem, maybe there's a new baby, and the older child's jealous, and this feels serious to the parents. It feels overwhelming sometimes, understandably. So often when they consult with me, I will, you know, in addition to allowing the older child to express emotion, to cry and all that, and express jealousy, I also recommend several forms of play for these kinds of situations. And actually, the one single kind of play that I recommend the most often is what I call power reversal play. And that's when you, I mean, the classic example is a pillow fight with a child where you, the adult makes feeble attempts to maybe hit the child with a pillow, but the child really gets into it and the parent role plays, pretends to be weak or frightened or, you know, just kind of scared, frightened, weak, and falls down. Just kind of say, oh, you knocked me over. So the child feels powerful. And children, almost every child I've ever met has really enjoyed hitting their parents with pillows and seeing them fall down. Okay.
I used to, with my daughter, Allie, and her visiting friends, I used to get down on all fours on the rug and play knock the bear over.
Uh-huh.
And the kids would climb on me
and stand on me.
And the great moment came when they toppled the bear over.
Yeah. So that's wonderful. That's wonderful. And people, I think parents and grandparents do these things spontaneously. I think we don't always realize the therapeutic value of it. you know, fathers do a lot of roughhousing sometimes with their kids, but the kind of roughhousing that's most beneficial, sometimes dads need help with this, is to really let the kids win. Let them feel like they've won and turn it into a game. Don't get too serious with it. So this can work wonders. It's kind of amazing how that works, but like an older child who's jealous of a new sibling, I mean, if they can just not, you know, have a 20-minute pillow fight with their mom or dad, often it's the mom they're angry at because the mom is the one who really brought this little intruder into the home. So they're mad at the mom. And from a child's point of view, it's really as if, you know, someone said to a man, if a woman said to a man, I'm going to bring another man to live with us, and I hope you'll love him as much as I love, you know, I'll love him as much as I love you, and I hope you two will get along. So I think children are justifiably angry at their mom, but if they can express this and just have a fun pillow fight and laugh about it and see their mom playfully just kind of fall down and join in the play, that can really dissipate a lot of jealousy, a lot of anger.
I just opened your book randomly, because I've been experiencing that opening your book randomly is quite interesting. And I opened up randomly to one of the toughest subjects that parents get really uptight about, and that is lying, cheating, and stealing.
Oh, yeah.
And,
mm-hmm.
and I'm going to read what you wrote. And
okay.
I think this may be the first time I've done this on the air.
Okay.
A playful approach can be effective, especially if your child denies that he stole something either from you or someone else. Don't force him to confess. Instead, accuse a stuffed animal. Teddy bear, did you take the chocolate? Then scold the teddy bear with fake seriousness. Teddy bear, you mustn't take things that belong to other people. By this time, your child will probably start to giggle. You can continue the playful activity by making the teddy bear steal additional items while you fake anger. You can even create a story in which a child bear steals items from a mother bear, mm-hmm. and builds a huge pile of stolen items in the middle of the room. The mother bear frantically searches for the stolen items, even though they're in plain sight. Encourage your child to play one of the parts. I think this is just a lovely illustration of playing as a therapy, as a lesson, and as bonding, and as not just getting on your high horse and making your child feel really bad.
Yeah, because that's not going to help. It's just, you know, saying, okay, we don't steal, this is, you know, you go to your room or some kind of punishment, that's not going to keep the child from stealing in the future. That, you know, any kind of scolding or punishment is just going to make them get better at being sneaky and hiding and getting away with things.
Yeah, so, either that or they get caved in and paralyzed because we can shame and humiliate enough until we have a withdrawn child. But I agree with you.
Right.
The child's either going to get better at it or withdraw. People don't become positive, loving, outreaching as a result of shaming and punishment.
They never do. They make conform.
In the book, you call this symbolic play / nonsense play.
Yeah. That's
symbolic play / nonsense play, in which you role play activities about lying or stealing with stuffed animals.
Yeah, that's actually two kinds of play rolled up in one. Yeah. That can
what age group are you thinking about here?
Well, this book ranges from actually birth to age 12. And some of these examples are more appropriate for younger kids or older kids. But that age range would be like age 4 to 8, maybe,
mm-hmm.
you know, for that particular example. And the point I make, too, is that, so the play serves the purpose of allowing the child to release. It brings it all out in the open. It allows the child to release tension through laughter. It strengthens the parent-child connection. But and it gets at the root of the problem, which is often a feeling of disconnection. Children do a lot of these behaviors because they feel disconnected. In fact, I really feel that most behavior problems are not caused by a lack of discipline. They're caused by a lack of connection. And so anything we can do to strengthen the parent-child connection, to really help children feel they're loved and cherished and that we enjoy being with them, that is probably the most important thing that parents can do. And discipline problems then just tend to go away. I mean, they just tend to go away. They dissolve.
Yeah.
And the child who cheats, that's in that same chapter, at board games and things, the most helpful response is to just turn it into a power reversal game and just be the bad loser. Oh, no, I'm losing. How did you get that? How did you get all those kings in a checker game or whatever? I'm losing. Oh, no, I never get to win. Because a child who cheats at a board game is actually, I feel that child is actually inviting their parents to play a different kind of game. They want to play a game in which they get to release emotions and feelings of insecurity. And the best way to do that is to just turn it into a game. And bring it out in the open and just laugh about it.
So I think what you're saying is really, really important. And I think that a huge amount of issues in parenting can be handled by lightening up, knowing you're the authority so you don't have to enforce it, knowing you're the parent so you don't have to shout about it,
mm-hmm.
and instead guiding your children to see things in a more humorous light and to understand that they can learn without being, you know, knocked mm-hmm. about, without being shamed and humiliated.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I'd love to share a little example of using play to help a child who was aggressive with his mother, a real example of one of my clients.
Go ahead.
It wasn't even a consultation. I was staying with a family during one of my workshop tours, and they had a four-year-old boy who was a sweet, sweet child, very gentle, very sweet. And we were in the kitchen with his mother, and she was telling me how they had just moved to their new home, and they really enjoyed it, and it was much bigger than their old home. And he was kind of listening, this little boy, and he, all of a sudden, out of the blue, he went over to his mother and just hit her in the arm as hard as he could. Well, she looked at me and she said, "Okay, Alisa, what do I do?" And I just said to the little boy, "Wow, you're really mad at your mom, aren't you?" And he said, "Yes." I said, "Are you mad because you didn't want to move to this house? You liked your old house?" He said, "Yes." And then I said, "Well, would you like to have a pillow fight with your mom?" He said, "Yes." And he ran and got pillows, and we moved to the living room, and I coached them in a 20-minute pillow fight in which I told the mom, just fall down. Pretend that he really is knocking you down. Just fall down. So we kept him laughing for 20 minutes. He loved it. He just loved it. All this aggression came out of this little boy. And then I left the next day, but she sent me follow-up emails, and it's so interesting what happened. About a few weeks later, he hit his mother again about something, and she suggested a pillow fight. They had another pillow fight. And then she wrote about 2 weeks after that, he came to her and said, "Mom, I'm angry. Let's have a pillow fight." He never hit his mother again after that, and they had lots of pillow fights. So that it really is amazing, you know, what this can accomplish, this whole playful approach.
When we come back, we'll be taking a break in about a minute or two. When we come back, I want you to give some more examples, or to help me, I'll just read your book aloud.
I can give more examples.
You do. Examples are so important. And maybe we'll go over some of the things that you mentioned in your book about what attachment play is and isn't. It's a nice list of things that you give in your book, Attachment Play.
Mm-hmm.
Let me close now with reminding folks, as we're getting down the wire, that it is time to sign up for the Empathic Therapy Conference. Learn about empathic therapies. Learn why psychiatry as it exists today does more harm than good. And hear from people who are doctors and lawyers and judges and parents and former patients and therapists. Learn about how wonderful and better approaches there are. Now, I think attachment play is one of those approaches. We'll be back with Aletha Salter, S-O-L-T-E-R, in a few minutes. And this is Dr. Peter Bregan, and I'm happy to have my guest with me today, Aletha Salter. Aletha, how do you pronounce your last name?
Yeah, that was about right, Salter or Salter. I say Salter.
Salter. Got to get a little bit of the O in there.
Yeah.
S-O-L-T-E-R.
Mm-hmm.
One of your stories, you're describing volunteering at a school, and there's a lot of pushing and shoving going on that day, a lot of aggression you hadn't seen before. So instead of doing psychoanalysis or threatening the kids or sending them to the principals, we sat in a big circle. We all practiced making angry faces. I called the feelings strong feelings rather than labeling them as bad or mean. I said, I see a lot of strong feelings. Can you make some strong, angry faces? The children really got into that. I clarified, no sounds, just faces. We went around the circle and looked at each child's angry face. And you have your one child rolled his terrible eyes, another shoulder, terrible claws, just like in the book that you were looking at. And then we made some happy faces. So now we get into the other side of it, the positive. You just didn't leave the kids with anger and big faces and bad faces. The kids loved this activity and laughed a lot. Then they all started playing well together. I felt very good about this approach because it really worked, you say. Another good story about just intervening in a positive, playful, loving, positive way.
Right.
Being in charge, which I think people are afraid to do, and being imaginative. I'm sure a lot of parents find it a little scary trying to be that imaginative.
That's a good example. This was actually a mother who reported that to me.
Oh, okay.
It wasn't me. I can't take credit for it. it's wonderful. It's just another example of a playful approach. Just acting out, exaggerating what the anger and the aggression and it really can work wonders, this approach. Yeah.
Any stories in particular or more thoughts about it? I mean, I think there's some of the important things that you talk about also just more abstractly is what it isn't, what this kind of play therapy isn't, that it's not permissive.
No, it's not permissive parenting. People might, I worry that people might get the impression this means that there's no limits or anything. This is not true. It's important to set the limits and boundaries with children, but we can do it in a playful way. And children are much more willing to cooperate when we win them over. I mean, that's the key. We have to win children over. And if we're going to avoid the use of punishments and rewards, which is I don't recommend either, we have to win children over. And it doesn't mean letting them do whatever they want. Just means establishing a good relationship, making things fun, and they will want to cooperate.
And another point you make, which is really appropriate for the story I read, and that is attachment play does not teach children to be aggressive.
Not at all. This, and people, again, people might think, the power reversal play that I described earlier, the pillow fights, people might think, you're just making them more aggressive. You're not. It's cathartic. It gets it out of their system. So it really accomplishes the opposite, and children become much calmer, less aggressive after these forms of play. And it's not a form of teasing. Even though there's laughter, it's not teasing.
Not humiliating. You don't belittle anybody.
No, never, never. An important thing is it doesn't involve competition. There are no winners or losers. No winners or losers. Except, you know, by the power of ruthless play, you let children feel like they've won, but it's all done and you're not keeping score or anything. And it really doesn't have any set rules. And parents, you know, can invent their own. There's just basic principles and some few basic kinds of play. And then within that framework, parents can, you know, just create their own versions. Now, I'd love to share another, yes, for more examples, another one of my clients.
Please.
That's really, really a very dramatic example. It was a mother consulted with me, and this was by telephone. A lot of my consultations are by telephone or by Skype, because these are people who don't live anywhere near where I live, and they may even be from another country. So I do a lot of telephone and Skype consultations. This is a mother who had a four-year-old boy who was adopted, and he'd been adopted at the age of 10 months from Eastern European orphanage. I think it was Romania or something, from an orphanage. He'd been put in the orphanage because his biological mother had died when he was just 2 days old, and he was abandoned by his family, who felt that he had somehow caused the mother's death. Okay, there were lots of older siblings. There were grandparents who were overwhelmed, so they just put him in the orphanage, didn't want to have anything to do with him. So he was abandoned. So they adopted him at 10 months, came into this wonderful, loving American family who really wanted him. Well, given that kind of trauma history, not surprisingly, he started showing behavior problems early on. And by age three, it got so bad, they took him to a behavior therapist who recommended they put him in timeout when he had tantrums and noncompliant behavior. And this, in my opinion, is one of the worst things he could have recommended, aside from psychiatric drugs. I brings up a point. I really feel that there's a commonality between psychiatry and behavioral psychology.
Oh, they're very closely linked, yes.
Yeah, because in both approaches, we're doing things to children instead of working with them. And so the behavioral approach, this you know, the timeout and the gold stars, all that, it really, really doesn't help in the long run. So they'd been using timeout for a year, and especially for a child who's already suffered separation trauma, you know, to forced isolation for such a child when we need to be strengthening the connection, it's just really the opposite of what's needed. So his behavior only worsened. By age four, they described him as strong-willed. I'm looking at my notes here that I took at the time. Impulsive, distractible, noncompliant, prone to tantrums, aggressive, prone to jealousy, poor peer relations. He hit other kids at school, always wanted to be first, and he frequently ran away and hid when asked to do something, both at home and at school.
He took his own time out.
Yeah, he took his own time out, but it was kind of like a defiant thing, you know, when someone wanted him to do something. So they'd taken him to a psychologist who labeled him at risk, and I don't like that expression, but at risk for ADHD, attention problems, conduct disorder, and basically he was starting to get labeled, okay? And that's when they discovered my work. They discovered my books. They immediately stopped using timeout, and they scheduled a consultation. So the advice I gave them, I said, no more timeout, okay? I gave them tips on listening cooperation with non-punitive approaches. I told them, you know, do a lot of play with him, give him choices. We'll try to win him over. I told him to never punish his tantrums, just stay with him through his tantrums, that he had a lot to cry about. Stay with him. Let the meltdowns just run their course. Give him empathy. And I told them to play what I call the separation games. And that's a very important, one of the very important forms of attachment play. Hide and seek. Basically, hide and seek. He was giving a cue by his behavior as to what he needed to, how he needed to play. And I find that repeatedly that children do this. If we only pay attention, they let us know what they need to do to heal. They really show the way. They know. Their bodies know. He needed to play hide and seek. I told her to play hide and seek and chasing games every day and make it fun. Make it official. This running away and hiding, make it official. Make it a game. Go and find him. It's almost like he was testing. Okay, he'd suffered two separation traumas, one from his birth mother, one from the orphanage. It's almost as if he was testing, is this for real? Is this relationship going to last? And so she did. And you know, I also told her to read, you know, the book, The Runaway Bunny. I told her to read that to him. And she said, oh, it's already his favorite book. I said, okay, I'm not surprised. So then I didn't hear from her. 8 weeks later, she scheduled a follow-up consultation, and he had showed dramatic improvement. She followed my advice. He was less aggressive, much less aggressive. He had stopped running away. He was much more cooperative. He had better concentration and focus. He had begun doing quieter activities at school instead of just tearing around the room. Much more quiet activities. He had started painting. He had painted a picture of a flower with great care and thoughtfulness. And it was just unbelievable. And she didn't feel the need for any more consultations. The children turn around very, very quickly. I feel this is very powerful information. I don't take any credit for this child's, you know, change. The mother did the work. All I did was give her an hour, a few tips, you know. But the mother did it. Once she had the information, she knew what to do. Once she had correct information, good information, and it works. This approach really works. So that was very encouraging for me.
One of the, I think, the keys to a playful approach, the basic idea is attachment. The basic idea is it brings you closer. It lets you play through a difficult time.
Right.
It lets you kind of help the child reenact or act out things in a way that isn't harmful to the child.
Yeah, the whole symbolic play does that.
It's very important.
Right.
And also avoiding power. I mean, one of the things that happens that is just dreadful between parents and children in the modern day and age is that the parents get so frustrated and so locked in to being disobeyed or not listened to or whatever it is that they go for power. And, of course, it doesn't work nowadays. In the past, I think there was more room for parents to overpower their kids and have their own will and their own way. But now, you need to be respected. You need to be appreciated by your children. But you need techniques that aren't just overwhelming power and authority. And play is a big way to detoxify power struggles.
Absolutely, absolutely. And it can even help. And parents come to me who have been authoritarian, who have been punitive, who have hit their kids, who have yelled at the kids, who have used timeout. And the children are still, in a way, suffering from that previous approach to discipline. So the parents want help repairing the relationship. And that's where attachment play comes in, too, because you can just repair your relationship at any time with a child. And no matter what the problem is, even when parents aren't the source, the child's problem, parents can always be part of the solution.
I think it's absolutely true. And the other day, I was looking ahead to a session with a young boy. He's I don't want to be too specific about his age or identify him in any way, but he's preteen. And I was, concerned. I was a little tense about the session. The little boy had been in trouble. His mom was a little uncertain what to do. And I walked into the waiting room and saw them sitting there, and he was scowling. And I looked at him, and I said, why don't we give Mom a break and go for a walk? Mm-hmm. And he looked at me like, what are you talking about? I said, let's you and me go for a walk. We'll just wander around town for a bit. Why, his face so lit up, and we went for a walk. And we went by a creek that's runs through town. It's about 10 feet down in a cement channel. And we threw rocks into it, and we threw sticks into it. And I put my arm around him and held him a little bit because I was a little nervous. And then he picked up some more rocks, and he went up to the edge, which is perfectly safe because there's a big iron fence there. And he said, hold me.
Oh.
So I reached out very gently. I actually just held him by his hood a little bit. Didn't want to overdo it. And we had a lovely time. And I just, we must have spent about 30 minutes walking around town looking at things. He got to show me how smart he is and various things he noticed that I didn't notice. And then we came in and we sat down together and we talked a little bit with Mom and then said goodbye.
Aww.
And I think it was just a lovely opportunity for him to bond with Grandpa, be the Grandpa,
yeah,
and to feel more worthwhile.
Sure.
And to feel like the trouble he gets into isn't the end of the world. And, I think it's a real place for play. And we keep, and between us as adults, too.
Oh, absolutely.
I think it's really a healing process.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I wanted to add something to what you said earlier about parents who get caught up in the power-based methods of control. I think one reason some parents fall into that is because they were made to feel powerless as children. And so being an adult, it kind of like allows them to be the one in power. So a very important part of my work, this whole aware parenting approach, is helping parents heal from their own childhood and becoming aware of their painful emotions. And you've written that yourself. And you've been quoting from me. I'm going to quote from you, Peter. Looking at the childhood origins of painful emotions and re-experiencing their initial impact on us can help us transcend these emotions. You wrote that in Toxic Psychiatry. I like that so much I posted on my Aware Parenting Facebook page, and I so attributed it to you. But that's what I teach as well. That parents, we need to heal from our own childhood and from this urge to control and be and have all the power. And a lot of things change when parents begin to do that. And this whole approach, this whole non-punitive approach, becomes much easier because parents begin to relax.
I like it a lot. I like it a lot. And I'm very, when I see my kids in my office, I see kids with their parents and I see them, like talking back to their mom.
Mm-hmm.
I'll play with them about it, but it's really clear I don't think it's a great idea. I'll look at them and say, I can't believe that. What is that face you just made? Make that face again. I can't believe you made that face at your mother.
Bringing it out in the open, exaggerating. Whatever, yeah.
Yep. Making it playful, but
right.
So clear that I'm dismayed that they would do this.
Of course, you're not condoning it. Simply because you're playing with it doesn't mean you're condoning it.
There's not much of a way for them to fight me about that,
Yeah, exactly, exactly.
And if they do, it's now you're doing it to me.
Uh-huh.
But you have to avoid ridicule. It's got to be more in the sense of, I really like you.
Right.
And I'm playing with you because I think that's going to be a good thing for you.
Yeah, we're not teasing. We're not, one form of attachment play is playful imitation of children, but not in a teasing way. You know, just as a way of connecting.
Now, attachment play is just a part of your message. The big message, I gather, is attachment.
And yeah, yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about, I mean, attachment now is a word that is associated with a movement, really.
Well, there's attachment theory, there's attachment parenting. Attachment, my book is based on the idea that children develop, I mean, this is a research-based from John Bowlby, who coined the term attachment, meaning a child's tie with its mother. And now we recognize fathers and other people as well, of course. Mary Ainsworth's research on attachment of one-year-olds in a strange situation, on their behavior when their parent leaves the room. So it's based on that idea, and then all the follow-up longitudinal studies of children who have a healthy attachment at 1 year of age and how they turn out. And these longitudinal studies have gone on for, gosh, I think about 20 years now. And the research is very conclusive that children who have that strong attachment from the beginning, they do better in every way. Fewer emotional problems, fewer behavioral problems. So I use it in that sense. And also, attachment parenting is, there's a whole movement, and that is actually part of what I teach as well, that really, really emphasizing the connection, the closeness, especially early on in the child's life. I recommend men breastfeeding and also co-sleeping if that works for the family. So, and you know, carrying the baby as much as possible, not overdoing playpens and that kind of thing, just being with the child. So in that sense, it's attachment parenting. And, of course,
how do you feel things are going out in the world of psychology right now? Do you think we're moving in a more positive direction?
Well, not when I learned about that new diagnosis of it.
There you go. You know, psychiatry is not going to go in the right direction. It isn't going to go in the right direction. But I think a lot of other approaches, a lot of other fields are going in the right direction.
Yeah, there is a lot of exciting work happening out there. And I'm not the only one teaching, you know, new approaches to parenting that don't use power-based methods of control. There are more and more people doing this. I'm very encouraged. And I've led workshops in 16 countries, and
that's marvelous.
And everywhere, parents really are welcoming this information. They want to do things differently from the way they were raised. They come to my workshops. It's hard because parents don't have a role model for this kind of parents.
Elisa, we're getting toward the end of a very good show. My guest, Elisa Solter, S-O-L-T-E-R, her newest book, Attachment Play. Listen, if you want more inspiration, don't forget our conference, April 26th through 28th in Syracuse, New York. Go to empathictherapy.org. Empathictherapy.org. Come to our conference. Meet me. Get big doses of great people. Hope to see you there. And thank you again, Elisa Solter.